Welcome to the RSP cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. It is March 29th, close to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I hope you guys are having an awesome Friday and heading into the weekend excited, especially for those of you who know what happens at the end of this weekend. That's right. The 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio will be available April 1st, barring any act of God. I just finished the wide receiver chapter earlier this morning. It's the final one of the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio. And before I even do anything, I just want to thank the team of editors who've helped me out this year, and some of them for several years, for doing such a fantastic job. Because something you guys need to understand, I used to write for magazines. I used to be an associate editor for a magazine. Magazines with, you know, teams of people. They put together a 65-page magazine, a 70-page magazine, 80-page magazine, maybe quarterly, and it takes a lot longer to put that thing together. And what I'm asking them to edit is 484 pages. Over 380 of those pages are written in the span of a month, and I'm asking them to edit that. And so I want to thank Christopher Brown and Dan Hendry of Football Guys, Joe Baird, John Lieberman, Aaron Steffi, Al Scherer, Aaron Bronikowski, and the inimitable Gene Bramall for helping me out. And I want to give a shout out to Steve Volk, who initially did the legwork to help me put this together nearly 5 years ago. So I want to thank you again, Steve. The product's much better for it. And I want to thank, you know, those folks for really coming, you know, stepping up and helping me out, because it's incredibly helpful. This is, you know, as a writer, not a football analyst, as a writer, the RSP is at simultaneously has always been kind of my greatest joy and my greatest shame in professionally. And why I say that is that the idea of putting out nearly 500 pages of content that's new and not really your best writing and doing that every year, there's a part of me who, as a craftsman, as a writer, my football writing, I always feel like is my worst writing and has been my worst writing, because I know what it means to actually craft something of, you know, of quality and refine it. And I don't get to do that very often in the football sphere, but I love analyzing players. I love evaluating talent. And, you know, these folks here really did a great job of helping out. So if you know any of them, thank them on behalf of me as well. And I definitely will be thanking them, and I thank them profusely regularly. So let's talk about this wide receiver class, huh? We're going to talk about kind of the 10,000-foot view. I'm going to give you excerpts of things from the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio, so you get kind of an idea of some of the things that that's in the publication that you don't think about. Things that I put in there, they're kind of extra nuggets and goodies that I'll probably break out in articles in certain ways, and then some things that I normally reserve for readers and who buy it. And, you know, I'm not going to give away the farm here, you know, on a podcast. And I really couldn't, because I'd be on here for a marathon of a month to give away, you know, over 480 pages of content. But there's plenty of nuggets that I think are worthwhile to talk about in terms of philosophy of evaluating this class, wide receivers, as well as things about this class that I think are interesting, that I know that readers won't mind me giving away and will probably look forward to hearing before they even get the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. Of course, you can pre-order it and get a login and password for download that at mattwaldman.com. mattwaldman.com, W-A-L-D-M-A-N.com. And for, again, for, you know, for that price, you are going to get the Rookie Scouting Portfolio pre-draft publication. You'll get a login and a password. And when it's ready for download, I will email everyone who's already pre-ordered and let them know it's ready for them to go onto the site and log in, and they can download the PDF document. Then you also get the post-draft publication, which is an update that's available no later than a week after the draft, and is a really fantasy friendly publication that looks at depth chart analysis of, you know, how these players fit within their depth chart, which kind of gives you an idea of contracts for older players and where I think they'll stand, and kind of project the outcomes of training camp battles a little bit early. I do ADP analysis versus the RSP analysis and give you sweet spots of where you should draft guys. So for instance, you know, a couple years ago when I was saying Patrick Mahomes was the highest graded quarterback I looked at or evaluated in the past 5 years, and he was my number one guy, I knew that he wasn't going to be the first guy off the board. So, you know, I helped you find a sweet spot of where you could pick him and get some value, but not wait so long that you don't get him. Same thing with like Nick Chubb, who I had slightly ahead of Saquon Barkley. I'm not telling you to pick him ahead of Saquon Barkley, but I could tell you where you might be able to get him. So that's a helpful thing. And then in addition to those two documents, which is probably over 600 pages of content that is fairly evergreen, well, not evergreen, but certainly has a longer shelf life than you would expect, 2, 3, 4 years oftentimes, you also get on my mailing list, and I do a monthly newsletter that has rankings updates for the past 3 years of draft classes for those positions, and gives you updates about how these players are performing in the NFL. And I do that monthly from June through December exclusively for Rookie Scouting Portfolio subscribers. Now, what I'm going to be doing, and this is new, is I'm going to be opening up a part of the newsletter for a charge for, I think I have to look at what I'm going to charge it for, but I'm going to announce it a little bit more officially soon. I'm going to open up a part of a newsletter where it doesn't include the rankings updates, but it gives you an idea of some of the things that I look at and I'm working on. And if you're interested in learning more about the Rookie Scouting Portfolio and the things that I do, you can subscribe to that newsletter. You won't get the rankings updates over the past 3 years that the RSP subscribers get, but as someone who's interested in the newsletter and wants to see what I'm looking at for the 2020 class, how I'm looking at the 2019 class and how they're performing, I'm going to give exclusive content to people for that as well. So look forward to that. Finally, let's talk about this wide receiver class, 10,000 foot view. Okay. So let's start with last year, a little bit of thoughts about last year, because I thought back then there were 45 to 50 receivers with the talent to make a roster. And I thought there were 25 with starter potential in terms of potential development to grow and become a player who could be on the field within the next 3 to 4 years. And I thought 24 of those players who had starter potential had 1,000 yard production potential. And, you know, obviously that's just potential. Potential and reality are very different. You know, I have the potential to be, you know, a black belt in Taekwondo, but I have to do something about it. So, you know, you divide each number. I kind of look at it this way. I joke around that I have an unscientific attrition factor with the number of players I say who have starter potential. You know, guys who have off-field issues, people who just aren't quite mature enough to really devote what they need to be professional, injuries, politics that, you know, maybe prevent them from being able to get the opportunity that they actually earned, and then they lose their confidence and they quit, whatever the reason is. My little unscientific attrition factor for those, you know, 25 players is that, you know, I'll divide that number by 3, and then you have a realistic projection of what happens when potential no longer matters. And we'll say that as a result of that attrition factor, 7 to 8 of these starter prospects from 2018 probably have 1,000 yard potential. Okay. So when you look at this year's 10,000 foot view, I think it's similar, but the difference is that it's much more top heavy at the rankings when you rank them out. Cause I think there's about 45 to 50 receivers with the talent to make a roster, and 27 of them, a couple more, have starter potential in the next 3 to 4 years. And 17 of them, though, instead of 24 of them, only 17 of them, I think, have 1,000 yard potential. You know, considering the depth of talent that's already stocked from previous years' classes, I think it's safe to say that, you know, that basically there's going to be maybe 10 to 11 receivers total with potential to make a roster, and 6 to 7 of those with starter potential. But there are more players this year than last year that I think can become reliable starters with that 60 to 80 catch, 800 to 1,000 yard, and maybe 6 to 8 scores, regardless of what their quarterback talent is. I think 10 of those 12 have the potential to develop into perennial Pro Bowl players. Now, potential and reality are different, but again, regardless of the potential to start, there's an abundance of wide receivers this year that I think have the potential to play a decade in the NFL. This is a good class. And as with every class, there's going to be players who don't play to expectation, and then there's going to be guys who wildly exceed them. Guys I'm going to be wrong about, guys I'm going to be right about. My job is just to give you an idea of who can be good and why. And at this early vantage point, 2019 is an excellent class for drafting receivers if you're patient and realistic about the overview of the position. And with those 10 players with a legit shot to develop into leading receiver for their team in the next 2 to 3 years, this is one that if you're a fantasy player, you definitely want to be at the top of the board. But I think there's a lot of players also who are in this class who are complementary starters, you know, possession receivers, deep threats, yards after catch specialists who can be productive. And I think there's 15 players out of the 25 on the board of the top 25 who I think can fit that complementary description. So it's a rich class. And it's not what I've always, you know, I've called it the revenge of the big man, because last year, the past 2 years, I've been writing about how it's been a hybrid receiver class, that, you know, any talk of playing up the big and tall receiver over the past 2 years is a product of wishful thinking and probably over projecting based on what I would say are kind of old school, bigger, faster, stronger, quicker, higher is better theory of analysis, where what ends up happening is people over inflate or maybe even double score in their favor when they're athletic or when they fit prototypes, as opposed to just saying, hey, they meet the standards for these bucketed tiers of, you know, good enough, average, above average, good, great. And you can put them into tiers. But to me, it's like you could look at, for instance, DK Metcalf and Hakeem Butler. DK Metcalf ran a 4.33 40. That's great. All right. Hakeem Butler ran a 4.48 40. That's also great, if you, at least in the way that I define tiers of that. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. You know, DK Metcalf's much faster. He's 4.33. Okay, sure. But they're in within the same tier. So at that point, are you really going to keep, you know, rewarding DK Metcalf for being super duper 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 fast? There's a point of where it's just diminishing returns. So let's kind of talk about these two guys, because a lot of people are saying, you know, that Hakeem Butler is a polarizing receiver as far as being the number one guy. Let me tell you something. Hakeem Butler is the highest scored receiver, or received the highest score in my depth of talent rankings, and I've started doing depth of talent, I think 5 or 6 years ago. He's earned the highest score in depth of talent for a wide receiver that I've ever given to one. Okay. So I'm going to explain why Hakeem Butler's my number one receiver, other than the fact that he's just a bad mother, shut your mouth type of thing. Okay. So before sharing more about Butler, and I'm not even going to probably share a ton about him here, I'm going to let you read about that in the RSP, but there's layers of information about the receiver position, the NFL scouting process, and the RSP scouting process that I think you need to understand when you think about, why do I have a player ranked number one? And why would a player like Hakeem Butler be number one when everyone's talking about DK Metcalf, who is a fine, fine prospect? But I think this will help you understand the context of the rankings of other players at the RSP, as well as even other independent scouts and media, and even the NFL as a whole. Okay. First of all, you have to understand the wide receiver position has three different roles. There's split end, flanker, and slot, and each role emphasizes specific skills and traits over others. So when an NFL team builds its draft board, it's going to scout the roles that it needs, not the position as a whole. So this is an initial decision filter. It filters the wide receiver pool to a manageable number of scouts, a manageable number of players for the scouts to study. And there's no point in studying 80 players. That's not going to, if you're looking for a slot receiver, especially if 80 of them won't play in the slot when your team only needs to focus on 12. I mean, that's just a misallocation of resources and your biggest resource being time. So to complicate matters a bit, teams will also filter the receiver pool by players who can also perform multiple roles. Think about that. I mean, there are guys who can play flanker and slot, or split end or flanker, or who can play all three. So this is why you're going to get a little taste of or a hint of what I'm going to get at here, is that this is why Dante Pettis was my number one receiver last year. The first thing, too, that the 49ers told the media after it drafted Pettis is that it coveted him because he could play multiple roles within the wide receiver position. You know, some you're going to hear planes. Hey, Josh Norris, you've got trains. I've got planes when I open up my window. So some players like Pettis, they can perform all three roles. Okay, others are only capable of one or two. And you have to think about, based on the offensive scheme, the organizational philosophy, teams are going to have preferences not only for how many roles the guy can play, but also specific player archetypes. We talked about player archetypes in the RSP cast about running backs, you know, body type, style of movement, and how that player expresses his play on the field. Is he physical? Is he a finesse player? Is he aggressive? These are things that all fit into what kind of traits you want your player to have, regardless of what position they play. So the NFL's 32 teams, they consider a lot of these factors when they filter the wide receiver position pool into these roles. And so this is going to create different grades for the same players across the league. And it's going to be for reasons beyond variation of that one scout had a Kroller this morning and the other one had some Jack Daniels the night before. You know, this is for reasons beyond what they see and understand about the game. It's you know, let's continue with Dante Pettis as an example here. As the 2018 RSP's top-ranked receiver, you know, for a team that was seeking, say, you know, he was my top-ranked guy, but say for an NFL team, if they were seeking a split end, Pettis would have qualified for that filtering down to that role of guys who were potentially split ends. But when studying him solely as a split end, they might have looked at him and said, oh, you know what? What we like from a split end, he's five on our board among the receivers that we're studying at split end. And then as a result, maybe he earns a fourth round grade from them. You know, he was drafted in the second round, but other teams may have given him a fourth round grade. There's some variation there, but it's not because they didn't see whether he was good enough in a certain area or not. They might have even recognized the same things. Well, maybe they didn't, but you get the gist of what I'm looking at here. Now, say a pair of teams are seeking a slot receiver. Pettis is going to qualify for that as well. And so maybe they're seeking the archetype of a small slot option, you know, like Wes Welker. Now, Pettis is bigger. He's not as quick as Welker. And they grade him out along that template, and he's the seventh player on the board of slot options, and maybe they gave him a fifth round grade. Now you're looking at an even wider variation from where he actually ultimately went, which was the second round. And that's why people go, wow, how did he fall that far? They must not know what they're talking about. There's a little bit more to it, as you can start to see. Say the other team's seeking a big slot, and Pettis, he also qualifies for that. Maybe their cutoff is 6'2 or 6 feet and 210 pounds. And they can project that Pettis is reasonably going to add enough weight to be at that 210 part mark or pretty close. And so he qualifies, but they want someone who's even bigger. They're not wanting a guy who just, you know, barely hits that surface unless he's just blows it out of the park in certain skills. And maybe Pettis is really good in certain areas, but not in the ones they're looking for. For instance, stronger slot options that can really block. guys who might be able to do tight end type of duty in certain run situations from passing down sets, which allows that offense to maintain personnel flexibility and unpredictability. And maybe Pettis just can't quite do that. You know, he's a decent blocker on the outside, but manning him up against an outside linebacker is probably a losing proposition. Whereas with some of these other guys, they can get it done just long enough that it's going to help the plays work. So they're going to have Pettis say eighth on its board with a fifth round grade. So suddenly you're looking at a variation of a guy who might have a second round grade in one place, who might have a fourth round grade in another, and a fifth round grade in the other. And this is one of the major reasons why wide receiver is the greatest variation of draft grades of any position in football. Now, you need to understand something. The RSP doesn't filter positions this way. Because while it's an intriguing possibility for me to go that route and filter people down by different position types, you know, the priority on the list of newer updated processes for the RSP, this is not as high as other areas. Because while I have a significant football audience, my primary audience in terms of the number of people who buy my publication, they remain fantasy players, and they're seeking rankings based on production potential, and that cuts across all these different types of roles. So while discussion of role has value, specific pre-draft rankings of split ends, flanker, slots, guys who can play two roles, guys who can play three roles, it's not as important as me providing one ranking of the position as a whole. And I think that's the case for other independent evaluators as well, is that we analyze a much larger pool of wide receivers than the average NFL team. I mean, the RSP grading of wide receivers, I think I looked at over 80 receivers this year. You know, that's not what most teams do. They may look at a fraction of that. So then we get to grading and how I grade because of all that information I just provided, because I don't filter it, because I'm looking at three different roles and grading three different roles all using the same system, I have to distribute my points across certain analysis criteria to account for all three. So, you know, one of the differences is, of course, is that most teams don't place as much weight on the vertical game for slot receivers, at least not traditionally. And this position tends to get pushed down in the rookie scouting portfolio's board. Not always. I mean, if you got guys, but the thing is that, you know, Wes Welker can't go deep. He's not going to go deep on a regular basis. He's not going to get matched. He wasn't going to get matched up against Charles Woodson and win that matchup. Okay. So what I would often do is I would provide a small section in the chapter that split out wide receivers who were slot players for a brief discussion so that you could look at that in context and understand that I may have had him rated 18th on my board, but he's actually the number two slot receiver on my board. And that way you got a little bit better context and you're not thinking that I'm like, I don't know how to grade the value of a talented player. So at the same time, one of the things we're noticing is that the NFL is starting to adopt spread offenses. They're having a need for big play slot receivers who can get vertical. And just by happenstance, because of the way the NFL is going, the RSP's grading system is starting to become more inherently aligned with that growing trend. Because slot receivers are becoming more versatile. And so the RSP's criteria to begin with slightly favored versatility in its positional grading. So let's get to, you know, DK Metcalf. I mean, listen, man, he's a big time split end. He's got massive strength, blazing speed. Dude can leap tall buildings in a single bound, right? But he plays one position well. And there are skills that he's got to address. I mean, there are skills that are common to all three receiver roles. And, you know, I know we've heard that Metcalf, you know, slipped during his combine and workouts. I'll tell you something, you know, just go watch Drew Lieberman at the Sideline Hustle, who I've had on this show a couple times. And he's doing some workouts with Jay Sternberger and Juwan Winfrey on his YouTube channel recently. He got paid, you know, he was Sternberger's agent asked him to coach him up, and Winfrey is one of his clients. And he's talking about route running and releases and things that require short stop start quicknesses and change of direction that are really the things that the three cone drill and the 20 shuttle are trying to mimic to a degree, or at least approximate. And one of the things you notice is that when receivers fall down, other than, you know, hazardous or slippery ground conditions, is that usually that's because they're not quite refined in their execution of technical tasks that have to do with the route running itself. It's kind of like quarterbacks who wait a beat too long to do something, and they're thinking too fast or too slow, and the ball comes out inaccurately. Well, when you're thinking too fast or too slow, when you're running routes and release plans and footwork plans, you slip. And that usually is a demonstration that you're not quite as comfortable with certain types of footwork and certain types of bends and drives and breaks. And Metcalf isn't. And part of that too is also some physical limitations there. And that's okay. It still makes him a terrific prospect. But he plays one position right now. Okay. And he's not going to need that to as much of a degree. And there are compensating traits that he has that, even though you'd like to see him be better at the things that he's not so good at, there are things that he does so well that it can kind of override that. And you'll learn more about that in the Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication. But in contrast to Metcalf is Hakeem Butler. He also has that star caliber athletic ability. But like I said, the Rookie Scouting Portfolio doesn't value bigger, stronger, faster, quicker, and hires automatically better. Once that player's athletic traits qualify for a specific tier, then they're all judged on skills at that point. So let's give an example. The star caliber tier in my skill breakdowns for wide receiver separation has a minimum requirement of athletic ability. And that's a combination of the 40-yard dash, the 20 shuttle, the three cone drill, and the vertical leap, among a few other things that I look at. And there are various combinations where a player may athletically qualify for that star tier based on his projected role and style of play. But there also can be some compensating factors, like I said about Metcalf, with skill that can give a player a slight bump to that next tier. Now, I tend to be cautious about giving those little bonus point bumps because I want to make sure that I'm not over projecting, a player because I feel dreamy about the fact that he runs a 4.33 40. You know what I mean? You know, there's a point where I don't want to get stars in my eyes because I'm so impressed that he was fast. But see, once a player meets the athletic criteria for the skills based, for criteria for that particular skill, say separation, RSP's process determines if the player possesses the baseline technical skills and conceptual skills to be placed in that tier. So say the player runs a 4.33 40 like DK Metcalf, and he could be in the star caliber separation tier. And you look at it, and part of the criteria for me is he has to show some comfort and facility with certain types of techniques at the line of scrimmage to get free. You know, that has nothing to do with speed. It has to do with whether he has the technical facility to do the work and whether he can handle a player who's good at countering him when he tries to do that. So there are going to be some things that he can do. And if he can meet those requirements, then he's going to get in that tier. But if he can't meet those requirements technically, then he doesn't belong in that tier no matter how fast he is. He's going to go to the tier below that. And then I'm going to give him some bonus points if I think he has the potential to acquire those technical skills. Follow me on that? So to me, that's kind of a way of going about doing it. Now, sometimes I will put a player in the athletic tier put him in the tier that his athletic ability corresponds to, even though he may not show, say, you know, Metcalf in the star tier for separation. Metcalf ran a 4.33 40, but his 20 shuttle three cone drill were, frankly, relative to what his, 40 was really bad in if you were to compare and contrast. You know, it was like reserve caliber or free agent caliber, you know. And you'd say, well, you know, you have to stop, start, and you have to be able to have quickness and good acceleration to win deep, don't you, Matt? I mean, so if he can't get off to a quick, if he can't get an open runway to accelerate long enough to get to that top speed, then he's going to be a bust. That's what some people might ask me. But the thing is there are compensating factors. As I keep saying, one of the compensating factors for DK Metcalf is that he is strong. He's strong and he's quick twitch from static movement in terms of like just standing still and using his hands and being able to use his hands with violence and suddenness. So a lot of the releases that he has that are successful sometimes are just kind of standing still when someone tries to jam him and then slapping that arm away. And he hits people with his hands with extreme violence. And he often wins by being able to make a sudden stop, push the man out of the way, swat the man out of the way, you know, rip the arm, rip the reach away, swim over top. And then because he's big, he's hard to get moved off of his spot and pinned to the sideline. You got to be really physical with him, and that's hard to do. And because he can accelerate even with you leaning on him, he's going to pull away from you. So that's a compensating factor, is his strength, even though his acceleration may not be quite as good as you'd like it to be. I think he's got more committee caliber acceleration. I haven't looked. I've looked at a lot of guys in the past 24 hours. You'll read about it. But the thing is that, you know, you look at these things, and I think that what often happens with grading players is that they're going to be guys who meet athletic criteria of a higher tier, but they're going to fall into a tier just below compared to other players who maybe they meet the athletic skills and criteria, but they're not as athletic. Say, again, Hakeem Butler versus DK Metcalf. Not as fast, but he also is quicker. He's also has more acceleration, and he also has more skills technically that fit within that high tier. Okay, so the problem is that our football society inherently values that bigger, higher, faster, stronger, quicker is better. And they don't account for the diminishing returns of you know, an ESPN sports science sideshow attraction lacking specific position skills. And so this is why the RSP rankings often have some striking differences from peers, because I think I've got a little bit more sober view of that athletic thought. And you got to, in contrast to Metcalf, Butler plays all three receiver positions, and he earns significant time playing in, you know, as a split end and slot. So his skills actually, when you watch the tape, have greater refinement and versatility. So that's why, just from a background perspective of how I score, how I look at the position, why Hakeem Butler's my number one guy, besides the fact that he's just a badass mother, shut your mouth. So let's talk about some other players now. One of the guys that I think is underrated, and who I talked about probably this summer, wrote about this summer, and then I haven't said a word about him until last weekend, where I just couldn't contain myself any longer. And I've kept some guys quiet purposely for my RSP subscribers. But this guy I already kind of talked about on Twitter, so I'm going to mention him here. Guy who I think is underrated is Stanley Morgan Jr. Okay, Stanley Morgan Jr., you know, a lot of people are going to look at him and say he's just a guy. He's a jag. He's, you know, but because he's like about 6 feet, 202 pounds, you know, average size, not unbelievable speed, you know, average speed, you know, for a starting wide receiver, maybe even slightly below average, but anything that's in the low 4.5s, you're good to go. Okay. So you've got that with Morgan. He didn't have any all-star game invitations, but he did go to the combine, which is, to me, is the biggest sign. Oftentimes that a team, unless you're, you know, Preston Williams, who we'll talk about in a minute, but give you a little teaser about that. But Stanley Morgan, you know, the fact that he went to the combine, even though he didn't go to the all-star games, fine. I think that's a good sign. Morgan, the reason I like him, or the reasons I like him, he's a high effort player. He's got excellent quickness. His routes are promising. His hand techniques, they're consistent. He's rock solid as a pass catcher. And he's an underrated open field player with and without the ball in his hands. And I think that one of the ultimate compliments that I hear frequently from football people when they talk about receivers is that when they talk about a receiver, if they say he can stop fast, that's a big deal, because the ability to decelerate is of paramount importance to route running. And Morgan does this as well as anyone in this class. So I even wrote, like, before I saw his combine metrics, that he may stop faster than he runs. Now, he runs 4.5 second 40, that which is more than fast enough, especially for a receiver who you're going to classify with possession plus skills. A guy who, you know, with play action, he can win with a secondary corner, you know, secondary option at cornerback. He's probably going to be able to hold his own and beat him, maybe even on occasion, the top cornerback. You know, because he's going to have good enough route skills. He also ran a 4.13 second 20 shuttle and a 6.78 second three cone. Now, let's put that in perspective, because those just sound like numbers to a lot of people. But with the context of those numbers, Deebo Samuel, who everyone's talking about being so quick and who is awesome, Deebo Samuel is only 0.05 seconds faster in the 40 than Morgan. Okay. Plus, Morgan topped Samuel in the acceleration and change of direction metrics I just mentioned. Only Miles Boykin and another player who I'm not going to mention, but I'm going to talk about, I'm not going to mention him by name, but I'm going to talk about him a little bit in a minute. Only two players had better performances in the 20 shuttle and three cone drill, the two metrics that are really relevant to receiver movement. Morgan was one of the fastest in this, you know, treasure trove of a class at the top of the board in those important metrics. You know, and you can see it on the field. I mean, his quickness and acceleration shows up in his routes and after the catch. And he's more than he's more than an underrated athlete, too. He has a terrific stick, which is really your front leg kind of jabbing hard into the ground. And this is a way of setting up breaks downfield. And it's not just a juke. People think about a stick where you're sticking your foot out and kind of jabbing outside or jabbing inside, and you move in the opposite direction. And they think, well, what's so special about a stick? Well, the thing is, the stick is both a move to be able to bait the corner one direction and go the other, but it's also the move that you use with your drive step. It's a drive step and a stick are very similar, because it allows you to drive and drop your weight and get into routes that break back to the quarterback. So you can use that stick. If you run it violently, you can have the defender thinking, is he going to break left or right? You know, if you're using your left foot to stick, then is he going to drive back to the inside? Or is he about to break down and basically drop his weight or turn with a sharp move and break to the outside or break back to the quarterback? So that's what the value of a good stick is. And his stick is one where he is violent with it, and it's in his wheelhouse, so he's difficult to really cover with timing routes man to man or off coverage when he runs that thing. Now, he also has some fake, really good fakes at the top of his stem that are really violent, and he uses them at the last possible moment before his break. So he plays up that suddenness so well, and that baits defenders. And so he's skilled at stretching these windows in zone coverage for his quarterback to find him. He's also boundary aware. He's a zone aware route runner. And I think most of all, he's really good at dishing out and taking physical play at the catch point. And also as a runner and a blocker, he takes hard hits. He maintains possession of the football when he can make defenders miss in the open field. And he does this a lot, and he runs through wraps. Now, the thing is there are a lot of people, and some of you may be old school draft Knicks, or maybe new school draft Knicks who've heard old school draft Knick ideas. because you'll go Nebraska, you know, what's good about that? And you like these Nebraska guys. You like Quincy Enunwa, and he's okay, but whatever. And you love Kenny Bell, and he's played in the AAF. Well, yeah, true. The Nebraska receivers haven't been known for anything since Irving Fryer, really. And that was back in 1984, I think. You know, that was the last time they had a receiver of that kind of import who I think was going to be an NFL starter, you know, annually. And I missed on Bell at least thus far, but there were certainly signs of promise there. But, you know, at the time, Nebraska's receivers for a long time haven't been known for anything other than blocking. And what's funny, though, is Morgan, as good of a receiver as he doesn't disappoint as a blocker. He's consistently strong at the point of attack. He excels at sustaining his hand position into opponent. I think he must have excellent grip strength based on what I see. And he gets under the skin of defensive backs because they're not used to dealing with a sustained physical play from a receiver. And when the guy's smaller than you or about your size and you're getting manhandled by a guy about your size, it pisses you off. And he certainly can do that. You know, and there's another affectionate, you know, phrase or term about football players who love the game. And when people say that a guy's a dog on the field or he's a dog about football, that's an ultimate compliment about a guy. I don't know where this article was, but it was an article last year about the Washington receiving corps. And they were comparing, the person who was writing this compared the attitudes of Josh Doctson and RSP favorite Paul Richardson. You know, Doctson's, you know, 220 plus pounds. Richardson probably weighs in the low 180s, you know, soaking wet. But the players were quoted as referring to Richardson as a dog who was all about football, whereas the writer characterized Doctson as a guy who just didn't quite love the game on that level, who certainly was talented, but you saw that he wasn't a dog about it. Hell, Morgan's own mom, in an article that I was looking at recently, has long referred to her son as a dog on the field. So when I think about Morgan's total game and why I find it exciting is that he reminds me of those old school AFC Central receivers. And, you know, I grew up watching AFC Central football, which is now kind of like the AFC North, but was a little tougher back then. And AFC North, to me, is still, and I'm biased, so don't at me, but AFC North is still pound for pound the toughest division in football in terms of physical toughness, physicality, the way that they play. And so when I think of old school AFC Central receivers, I think of Hines Ward, and I think of Keenan McCardell, players who were faster than you think, versatile playmakers, and they're tough for days. And so I'm a little surprised he isn't earning more attention, but if I'm right, I think he's going to get a little bit more attention, you know, down the line than he has lately. So Stanley Morgan, that's kind of interesting. So there's a player that's a potential gem in this class who I heard about, and I gave credit to the person for, you know, referring this player to me to watch back in October. I'm not going to say who you are because I don't want to give away who this player is. But if you're listening, thanks again. You know, but I did credit you in the RSP. But I won't say who it is, but this guy is a potential gem. And I've known about him since, I think, October. He was in my top 25 all the way until this week when he finally had his pro day. And let's just say that his metrics are, when I watched this guy, he reminded me of Marvin Jones, who, you know, was a big RSP favorite. When this guy's metrics came out and his measurements came out, they fit Marvin Jones. Okay. And his metrics, he had a starter tier vertical, and the rest of the drills, the 40, the 20 shuttle, the 6, the 3 cone drill, the ones that I've talked about a lot, they were all star tier performances. So there were also scouts in attendance And one of them is a respected veteran. I mean, with over three decades of experience. And he said this player might be the best prospect that the school has ever had. And now this school isn't a hotbed for wide receivers, but there is a notable player who is an alum of that school who was for a period of time had strong starter production in recent years, past 10 years. And they said, this guy is, oh yeah, he's a better prospect than that guy. And when I watch him on tape, I agree. The thing is that when you watch him on tape, and the fact that he looked to me, he reminded me of Marvin Jones. But when you watch him against that competition, you could mistake him for being, you know, a 6'4", 228-pound guy who's just skying over people. But he's not that big. He's just, you know, he's kind of an average size receiver. And so you kind of have to take certain things, you know, give it a grain of salt. And one of those things is, you know, if I felt more confident about this player's route running, translating quickly to the NFL game, he'd probably be a top 12 receiver on the RSP's board. But because the intricacies of route running are kind of a game within a game, and it requires a lot of subtle adjustments and tweaking for a higher level of competition, I just couldn't give him that kind of grade with confidence. And I think he also has some work to do to refine his releases. But he does remind me of Marvin Jones. They have similar speed and acceleration, change of direction, and vacuum cleaner hands. I think this guy that I am not mentioning by name that you can read about in the RSP is a better leaper, whereas Jones, I think, is a more refined route runner when they were both collegians. And I think that Jones also has a little more dog in him in the open field. But I think it's a favorable comparison, and he's going to be a player who's in my top 20 that you're going to want to know about, because the things that he needs to learn to be a good route runner are very addressable. And I think he will address them, and he will wind up having the opportunity to be a starter in the league. I think he can create that opportunity if he wants it and works at it enough. So, you know, one of the things about this class that makes it so strong is that there are a ton of receivers who I could have said they have some of the best hands in this class. I found myself starting to write it over and over, and I had to kind of change that or joke about it a little bit, because it just seemed like one after the other after the other, because everyone loves to see a receiver who can go up and win the ball and do that. So I had this thought while I was looking at a player. And this player was number 30 on my board. Okay. Number 30. And I still was thinking, he has some of the best hands in this class. Number 30. You know? So I thought, if the rookie scouting portfolio could hold a best hands contest for this class, I think, first of all, it would tell the NFL Combine's gauntlet drill to take a long walk off a short pier into a spike pit with a giant worm. And that giant worm would probably have a mouth filled with razor sharp megalodon teeth. Okay. Because I don't understand that drill. That has some value, but I'm not, some of the rationalizations for that I'm not completely there with. And that's a rant for another time. So instead, what I would do is I'd instill a tournament bracket with cash prizes. After all, look, it's still March, right? You could start thinking about tourneys. And this contest would feature a specific number of throws delivered to the receivers over a period of, I think, three different on-field sessions. And each of those sessions would feature a set of short, intermediate throws over the middle and to the boundary. And these would include one-on-one matchups with a cornerback and two-on-one matchups with a safety coming from the middle of the field. And so essentially we'd be working from about the red zone, either from the 5, 10, or 20-yard line, and throwing to each of these receivers. And I would create criteria for judging alongside my judges. And my judges would be, if I could get them, because, you know, this is fantasy land here, right? So, you know, I'm going to hold this on an island somewhere. You know, I'm going to have Steve Smith, Randy Moss, Brandon Lloyd, Larry Fitzgerald, and Odell Beckham Jr. They're going to be my judges to select these defenders and my judges to select, to help me form the criteria for scoring these performances that they stick by. Okay. And then I'd invite 16 of the best aerial artists in this class to compete over that 3-session period in an elimination tourney. And maybe it would be more. I haven't figured out all the details yet. You know, this was just kind of a daydreaming moment as I was writing about this player again, who's number 30 on the board, who I think has some of the best hands. Because I thought to myself, if I invited 16 of the best aerial artists in this class, I think this number 30 guy would be a dark horse to take the crown, like to win the tourney and walk away with the cash. And then probably when the sideline reporter, if we had it televised, you know, came up to him to ask for a post-victory interview, he'd say it was nothing different than what he did at Michigan State, you know, on a regular basis posting up. And that's injured wide receiver Felton Davis III, who is, you know, 6'3", 211. He's not fast. He's probably going to be a big slot receiver if he can return to health with that from that Achilles injury, because he was never even that fast in the first place. But the dude just basically, he's not the flashiest, but he's that guy that basically, I think your team goes, there's two guys in this area and they're both hanging off either arm. Yeah, still throw it to Felton because he's going to figure out a way to get it. I mean, he's that kind of guy. But who are those 16 of the best aerial artists in this class? So I listed the 16 I'd pick from this class, and they're in alphabetical order. Okay. There's AJ Brown. AJ Brown is, you see him a lot in the slot, but he can also play outside. He's got the speed to win outside. And I love how tough he is at the catch point. And he always seems to make plays with people hanging off of him. And it's kind of subtle because there's so much focus on the other two receivers at Ole Miss in certain ways. But AJ Brown is a physical dude who can go up and win the ball. It's a weird analogy, but whenever I think of AJ Brown, I think of Magic Johnson. And I think the reason is that Magic Johnson, you know, you see him as a point guard, and there are certain things you associate with a point guard, but he's built like a power forward. He could play center. You know, he was so versatile. And AJ Brown kind of has that vibe for me. Like, yeah, he's more of a big slot receiver, but if you ask him to play those two positions, you ask him to play that position, flanker, he could do that because he has the quickness and speed. He can, you know, he can run good routes. Split end, he could go up and win the ball in the air and get deep on you. Heck, he's built like a running back. I mean, he's built like Jeremy Hill. He could be a running back probably. If you need him to be a move tight end, you could probably do that too. DK Metcalf. Well, we know you watch DK Metcalf, and yeah, he drops the ball. He and Hakeem Butler have drops. Yes, but there's different types of drops, and I've talked about that, and I could probably do a whole show devoted to the different types of drops. But his are mostly focused drops. Occasionally he has poor judgment with how he places his hands at the location of a certain target. Again, correctable. But man, this dude makes some catches in the way that he's like, how would I best put this? DK Metcalf is like the power dunker, home run hitting, you know, hard punching first round knockout artist who captures the imagination of fans. Okay. And when he goes up and wins the ball in the air, he's so powerful and graceful and explosive to make catches. They're some of the prettiest catches and most difficult catches you're going to see in isolated moments. Then there's Deebo Samuel. Deebo Samuel, I mean, certainly you look at his hands and, you know, he tracks the ball extremely well. He's very graceful. But he's got underrated power to his game. He's someone that while he doesn't make the type of physical plays DK Metcalf is, he's graceful. It's kind of like, you know, let's not talk about how great Michael Jordan was as a dunker, but it's almost kind of like DK Metcalf was Dominique Wilkins and Deebo Samuel was a little bit more Jordan or, you know, more of a finesse dunker. Emmanuel and Jordan could do some power dunks, I know. I watched him all my young adult life. Emmanuel Butler out of Northern Arizona. This dude has magnets for hands. And I honestly think his attitude is that when he sees that he's going to be double covered, he's just thinking, oh, now they just have two guys who can't cover me. It's almost the attitude that permeates his game when he goes up for the ball. Of course, there's Davis, who I talked about, Hakeem Butler, who also has the drops, but they're usually focus oriented because just like a guy who slips during his routes because he's thinking too far ahead, he's thinking too far ahead about who he's going to run over, run around, or run past. And occasionally that happens with him. Jawan Winfrey. He's a guy I mentioned with Drew Lieberman. I've watched him make really strong adjustments to the football behind his break to be able to go up and win it at late windows. Really good. Underrated player. He reminds me of a lot of, Green Bay Packer receivers we see who emerge from like the depths of low draft capital to actually be decent starters. He kind of strikes me as that kind of player. Kelvin Harmon, who just doesn't get talked about enough in this class, but he is a really powerful, strong, steady pass catcher who you're not going to get through his air bubble to be able to disrupt him very often. There's little Jordan Humphrey, former running back out of Texas, big dude. He might be, he would be one of my favorites in the top five of this 16 because of the way that he can adjust to the ball and how strong his hands are. And he really is graceful for his size and graceful and powerful. Very good big slot candidate. Miles Boykin. Listen, I think if Notre Dame had a quarterback on the level of some of the top prospects in this class, Miles Boykin's stats would be unbelievable. And he really has nice concentration and adjusts the ball extremely well. And how could you not have N'Keal Harry? I mean, N'Keal Harry, whoo, some of the catches he makes he and DK Metcalf make some catches that you're just like, the adjustments on those are just fantastic. He really tracks the ball well with one hand, and he can kind of post up a player by bracing the back arm with the back shoulder and then just kind of bringing it down with the front arm on the front shoulder with tracking that you just would not expect. There's Preston Williams, who I'll talk about in a little bit. Reggie, and then there's a guy by the name of Reggie White, who I will definitely say is a definitely graceful catcher. He's a very good catcher of the football, who I think you're going to learn a lot more about. Stanley Morgan, talked about how good his technique was. Travis Fulgham and Tyree Brady. Fulgham, I think, is a physical guy who catches very well. And Brady makes plays where you're looking at it and going, how did he even get his hands to make that catch? Kind of some of the Paul Richardson types of plays we saw in the playoffs. So as you can see, I have some slower options in this little contest because I eliminated the need for speed. They're playing within, 20, 30 yards of the line of scrimmage based on where the throws are going to be in the back of the end zone. And so the guy who I think would be a potential underdog here would be Davis. I think he'd be at the top of my list. And so I just thought it would be fun to share that contest. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about here is Preston Williams. I'm not going to talk about his off-field. That's something that I wrote about. You can see a little bit more about that in the RSP. But comparisons are fun. They're problematic. To me, a player comparison is a lot like musician comparisons. I studied jazz. I would learn about it, even learning about it in an academic environment. I studied it that way too. And some of the jazz history courses I took, we would listen to music. We would literally transcribe solos, talk about the melody, the harmony, the style, and we would do comparisons from players that they learned from. And when you listen to talk to musicians, they'll often say, these are my influences. And if you listen to them and then understand the music well enough, you see an amalgamation of players that they have learned from and that they're influenced by, and they sound like an interesting mixture of all those guys. Football players are the same way. So giving a one-to-one comparison really isn't usually the best way to go. But sometimes they're fun fits, and they fit well enough that you can get away with it. Preston Williams out of Colorado State, I think he looks and plays like A.J. Green. He's wiry, strong, he's quick, he wins the ball with grace and in physical situations. And when you look at the tail of the tape between these two guys, there's some similarities physically as well. They're both 6'4". They were both 211 when they entered the league. Green ran a 4.48 40, Williams a 4.55. Green's 20 shuttle was 4.21, Williams was 4.36. Green's three cone was 6.91, Williams was 7.06, and their vertical, Green was 34.5, Williams was 31.5. Now, Williams and Green both have the starter tier for long speed for the 40, but Green's on the upper end of the range, and Williams is kind of right in the middle. The rest of Williams' metrics that I just compared, they're all in the starter tier, whereas Green's in the star tier. So you might look at that and go, well, see, they're not alike because they're both not stars, but you're thinking too literally. To me, there's a tenor. There's also a tenor about the pro day, just as an aside, that I think Williams expected to deliver more elite results. But regardless of that, let's just take it for what it is. The fact that Williams' style of play and athletic ability on film and in workouts is equivalent to a starter tier version of AJ Green. You know, I kind of joke that if I'm going to compare Williams, I'm going to say he's the starter model for AJ Green, whereas the real AJ Green is the upgraded all pro version, you know? So, and think about it. I would argue that, you know, Stephon Diggs is the starter version packet of Odell Beckham Jr. and Odell Beckham Jr. is the premium model, you know, of that type of receiver. Now, you know, Vikings fans and Diggs fans are probably going to argue with me that, and pretty vociferously that, you know, that Diggs is not the lower tier version of Odell Beckham. I'll hear that occasionally from some fans, whatever. That's fine. I'm okay with where you stand on that. And if you don't agree, but the overall point isn't to say compare Diggs and Beckham necessarily, but that there are players who might be a notch or a half a notch below a top talent and still be valuable. So when I see Preston Williams, I see a top 10 receiver in this class who, if someone were to ask me just, you know, a quick bite thing, which people are used to me not giving quick bite things, as you can see, I would say he's the starter tier, you know, toolkit for AJ Green, you know, whereas AJ Green is the all pro model. So there you go. Preston Williams, RSP pass catching contest. Any of you independently wealthy would like to fund that? Let me know. I would love to tell, you know, I know an island in Jamaica, or I know a place in Jamaica where it would be fun to hold this. Why Hakeem Butler's number one, and then the 10,000 foot view of the class. So there you go. Hope this gives you a little bit of a chance to quench a little bit of your thirst for the RSP that's coming out April 1st. I got some editing to do after I get a little dinner here and maybe a little bit more sleep. I've had about 4 hours of sleep in the past 2 days. But thank you all for listening to this podcast, for subscribing to my content, for being so supportive on social media and, you know, your emails, and the communications that I have with, you know, a variety of you. I try really hard to deliver the rookie scouting portfolio as a value that exceeds expectation every year. I'm beginning to feel confident that that's going to be case with this one. There's going to be big hits. There's going to be big misses. But hopefully what you'll come away with when you read the rookie scouting portfolio is that you get in-depth information that will help you for a while as a football fan in terms of education, as a fantasy owner in terms of both education and intel. And so, and for those of you who understand the value of what we give back to darkness to light, I'm glad that you appreciate that as well. I certainly appreciate them. So thanks. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll be seeing you on the other side of when the RSP is released.